Today's Bureau Briefing is brought to you by MailChimp. More than 16 million people, businesses, and agencies around the world use MailChimp's marketing automation platform to reach their customers and grow their businesses. Their features and integrations give agencies the power to help their clients succeed through marketing emails, automated messages, and targeted ad campaigns. Their detailed reports help clients keep improving over time and provide agencies with the insight they need to effectively advise their clients and inform their marketing strategies. MailChimp loves empowering agencies and small businesses alike, so that's what they focus on every day. And we thank them so much for making the Bureau Briefing possible.
Welcome to the Bureau Briefing, a podcast by the Bureau of Digital, an organization devoted to giving digital professionals the support system they never had. Each episode, we're going to talk to a member of our community doing awesome, inspiring things. Now for your host, Carl Smith.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Bureau Briefing. It's Carl, and with me today, I have a good friend, Marty Ringline. Now, Marty is one of those people who, like a lot of us, had a digital agency in the 2000s. But unlike a lot of us, he actually got out and seems to have been successful, although I'm not sure I truly trust it. How's it going, Marty?
It's going pretty good, man. Can't complain.
Yeah, I know you can't complain, you piece of crap.
Right.
We're all tired of it. No. No. So I kind of want to start back in the include days. Right. Now, you and I both have an affinity for the letter N. Right? I had Engine, you had Include. You went on to Invite. I mean, you kept using it. I eventually buried my past.
Whenever we come up with ideas these days, if we can find a five-letter domain that starts with the letter N, that's based on a real word, we'd get real excited.
It's a big fight. Yeah. So I remember when we met in person the first time was at South By. And it was you and me, and I think Garrett Diamond was there, and Aaron Mintley was there. And I remember we had a dinner and we were talking about like the service side and how it was so shaky. Right. Do you remember this?
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely.
And we were talking about, you know, if we ever had to send up a flare, like if anybody ever got in trouble, right. Like send up a flare. So I think I was the only one that ever did that. Luckily I didn't end up needing it, but it wasn't that long after that. It felt like you were able to sell Include to Twitter. How do you do that?
Yeah, so that's a good question, right? Because in those days, one, it was pretty rare to have a small like boutique agency that was doing well, but they started popping up, right? Like around, I feel like 2002 to 2005, we started to see a lot of them. And so for us, I don't really think we never got into the agency to sell it. I don't think we knew that. Well, when we first started, we were just babies. We were like 22 going on 23. And we freelanced and we wanted to do that, more of that. And we wanted to do it kind of our way. And we had this idealism back in the day when, you know, Jeffrey was writing that orange book of like designing with web standards. And we saw him fighting the good fight and we wanted to fight that fight, but like on the agency side. And we wanted to say, hey, you know, there's a way that you can do really great work. You can have really great environment. You can work with people that you really like, that inspire you. And like, you can have these things that we weren't seeing in day jobs. And we thought let's build something. And I think as we started to build that, we didn't know what it was going to become, but I think we found this spirit in us that really kind of defined who we were. In the beginning we got lucky. We were always able to be a couple steps ahead, and not that we were leading that. We followed the right people. So, you know, Jeffrey, I think, is a really good example where he's leading this web standards movement. So we by no means, you know, start that or define that. But at some point, you got to pick what side of the fight you're on. And we decided to pick Jeffrey's side. And it turns out that he wins. And web standards is, you know, now it's not even a word because it's just the way that we build websites, right? So it's kind of ridiculous. So we ended up, you know, just on those fights, picking the right side more times than not. And that put us in a position where we could start to be more of an R&D shop, more of a prototype shop. So, in the beginning, you know, we're just two guys, two laptops, you know, sitting on a floor, trying to make enough to survive. And that's the bare minimum for the business. But we get to a point where we've built a nice little agency. We've got a good team size, and we start doing more of this R&D work, and we start getting more Silicon Valley clients. And the big ones are Apple, and they're paying most of our bills at this point, and they're just constantly pushing us. They're constantly having us think about things that aren't possible yet. What could a future version of CSS, where a spec hasn't been written yet, do in a future version of a future device that had a future screen size with a JavaScript processor and a CPU, right? And it's like those are interesting things, because they were fun, and it paid nicely, but it got us constantly thinking about things that put us in a position where we were a couple steps ahead. Like the thing I really like thinking about now is as a designer, a world in which there's no interface. And I think that's really hard as a user interface designer. But like now, even to say that, I think if I had said that like 2 years ago, I'd be like, oh, what's he talking about? But now it's like everyone immediately knows what you're talking about. You're talking about like an Alexa app or a Slack bot. But back then, you know, when we had to design for something that didn't exist, it had to be like theoretical. There was no browser to test it in. We could use like, you know, versions of like Google Canary or something to test, you know, upcoming support for certain CSS, you know, say 3 or HTML5 things that we wanted to play with. But that put us in a position where it helped us start to move a little bit quicker, faster on things that like weren't ready yet. And that, I think, always put us in a position where we could be a little bit more innovative with our creativity, and that just got us on the radar of a bunch of people out on the West Coast, because we're East Coast agency, and so got us attention with people like Oracle, Apple, and then that gets us on, you know, the viewport of a Twitter. And so we're actually having two simultaneous conversations. Apple approached us about buying the company, and then Twitter came up at the same time, and Twitter was really exciting to us because it was early. It was 2012, and they were pre-IPO. You know, Twitter was, I mean, I still love Twitter to this day, but you know, it's not, its user growth isn't as hot as it once was, but it was a big, big up and comer. And so it was a really exciting time to go over there and just think about new things. You know, what would you do in a world where Twitter isn't what it is today? And you know, they haven't evolved or adapted as quickly as I think we'd all hope, but it's still a fun, I mean, even today, we still, as a team, think about Twitter constantly and like what it could be or what it should be.
So I understand so much more about you right now than I did before. And we've known each other for a while.
Yeah. And you got to stop me, man. Cause I can just like rattle off forever.
No, this is gold. I'm over here getting hammered. Just slamming. It's all good.
Nice.
But I never understood the R&D side of Include. And I'm sure you had a lot of NDAs and a lot of stuff that you couldn't share. And so because of that, I was always seeing kind of what the public facing side of Include was. I mean, I also understand why Include got that offer. We didn't even get a call from WhatsApp, right? I mean, InGen didn't get any calls. And it was because we were building websites, right? We stayed with that kind of safe what's coming in. And that's one of the things I've always admired about you. It's hard for me to say that word when you're listening, but whatever. You never really seemed worried. And I know that there are times where you have been. There are times where I've seen you. I think we were in Greenville, and you were like, hey, if this didn't work out, whatever, I'll figure it out. But it's one of those things that you always took what felt like risky chances, but I think you had it figured out somehow. Like, you knew this wasn't that risky.
I'm always ready. I've always got a plan B. And I like this saying that's pretty popular now. You know, I never lose. I either win or I learn. And so I'm always thinking about everything that we do. It always is pretty risky, but it's a pretty calculated risk too. I'm trying to think, okay, you know, how will this fail? And if it does, you know, where will we go from there with what we did? I never want to be like set back to zero. So I want to know, okay, I'm trying to get to like, you know, point X, but like if I can't get there, what are sort of my break? It's almost like responsive design. Like, what are the breakpoints along the way? Like, what else would happen if I don't get to say full screen, right? Like if I could only ever get to 320 pixels wide, like what would it look like? And so I think we look at business the same way we look at design. You know, it's like a flexible modular thing. It can always work, and sometimes it's better when it isn't the bigger thing and it's the smaller thing. But like, we know that no matter what, there's like an out here, and we're also, you know, we love the prototyping, we love the research and design. online part of it. So, you know, it's probably why we're more hip to like want to be a part of like an acquisition, why we more position ourselves that way, because we kind of want to think about like what's next. And, you know, that was kind of what was exciting about Twitter is they brought us in. And I remember a quote that one of the ladies on the M&A side said. She said, you know, we don't want to change you. We want you to change Twitter. And I thought like, oh, I mean, and ultimately doesn't play out that way, but it was like, it's always something that kind of stuck with me. And so, you know, at Eventbrite, we started Invite. Eventbrite just recently got acquired by Eventbrite. And here, you know, they've tasked us with thinking about the future. And I love this like Gretzky quote of, you know, think about where the skate to where the puck's going to be, not where it's at. And when I always think about R&D, that's kind of what I'm thinking about is it's hard, right? Because it's like, it's a guess on where that puck's going to be. None of us have any idea. And it's a risk if we skate one way or the other. But like, I feel like the more we do it, the better we get at it. I love this. Again, not to hijack this too much, but there's this one story that I read, on Business Insider. I think it was about Major League Baseball. And basically, long story short, they say that it's impossible for a human being to hit a Major League Baseball. Like it's just physically impossible. Yet we know they do it all the time, right? Like we go to baseball games and we see it, and it's impossible because the distance between the pitching mound and the batter and the speed at the ball, the brain can't, the eye to the brain can't process it fast enough to tell you when to swing, and no human being can do it. And the reason that Major League Baseball players can do it is they've spent most of their lives hitting Major League Baseballs. And so what they're doing is they're predictive. They're starting the swing before the ball was released, which I think is, you know, insane and crazy, but like they're taking in the entire environment. They're taking in everything that's happening. They know subtle wind patterns. They know the mood, the attitude of the pitcher. They know time of day. They know how tired they are. Like they can read all of that, like from the distance. And we can't do that because, you know, we don't do it every single day. When I think about like web and technology, I think like, okay, the more we do it, the better we get at it. Like we miss a lot. And like to your earlier point, like there's been a lot of times where I've been like terrified that like it's not going to work or it's totally going to fail. There's like at the Include days, there were times where even when we had Apple and they were, you know, more than 50% of our revenue, they take so long to write you that check. And I'm sitting there and I know it's coming and I believe that they won't screw me over, but I can't make payroll. And so I got to like take, you know, a line of credit out on my house so that I can pay people. And I think the thing that most upset me was on some level, I had to lie to my team, because not that I blatantly lied to them, but I withheld the truth. I never told them that like, hey, I'm taking out a line to pay for your payroll, which means if you can do the math that if Apple still doesn't pay, you know, by next payroll or the following payroll, like I'm going to run out and like, you won't have a paycheck. Right. And so I feel super confident and strong that I'm going to make this happen. And the reality is like for my team, like I'll sell my car, like I will go bankrupt for this thing, but they don't want to hear that. Right. And then like, I don't want them to like start thinking like, oh, I don't trust this guy or I don't believe in what he's doing, or I need to go start like preparing my, like update my LinkedIn or something. So those times are like, they're terrifying. They're scary. But I think the hardest thing is like, if you ever feel like you have to leave somebody in the dark, cause like team is like, if it can't be about trust, then like, I don't even think that's a team, right? It's a group of people who like trust each other. That's a team. If you don't do that, like that's just semantics. Like you're not a team. You're just a group of assholes trying to get something done.
I remember we had somebody that worked at Engine who told me one day, she goes, you know what? My goal this year is that you get a new car, because it doesn't feel good that you don't look successful.
Yeah.
You're the one in charge. So is that where we're heading, where we all have a crappy old Honda? Because that's not what I want.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, okay. And so I went out and got a new car. I didn't care about the car. It got me where I was going, you know, but to her, it mattered. Right. So you get acquired by Twitter. You go there. Now I don't know the truth of this story. I only know what I observed and what I heard. And I also ran into you in Vegas when you couldn't tell me about Twitter, but I knew it was something huge because you were out of control. You were having so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I think we had just signed, but they hadn't released it yet, which is like perfect. And we went to that I had like a Vegas trip planned up for that.
We went to that fancy French restaurant. You had your big gold chain on holding your drink. That was so huge. And the guy came over to explain what the appetizers were, and we had eaten all of them. It was awesome.
That was a good one, man.
So you go to Twitter. I don't have any idea how long the deal was, but I got the sense that you left halfway through and that whatever the money was didn't feel as important as the time for you. Is that right?
So it kind of works two ways. So with Include, there were two founders, me and Alex, who still work together to this day, started and sold Envite together. He's like two rooms over right here in Eventbrite with me. So we've been working together for 15 years now. But so no investors in that company. So the deal was a little bit easier. But essentially, you know, in a deal like this, there's same thing with the Eventbrite deal. There's kind of three components. There's upfront cash. There's stock in the company that's buying you, right? Which is, you know, in their minds, the equivalent of cash. They would just, a lot of pre-IPO'd companies, they value cash more than they do the stock. So they're more willing to give you stock. And then there's your employment agreement. So on those three sides, at the Twitter side, we legally, well, they call it the golden handcuffs, but we had to be there a year. And so if we leave before a year, we lose the first two, right? We lose the cash and in the stock. But the only thing that keeps you after the first year is the same thing of any employee. You vest over 4 years and you have your, you know, nice salary, especially in Silicon Valley. They're ridiculously inflated. So no complaints, but, and then you get, you know, more employee stock. And so, you know, you get that over 4 years. So anytime you leave, that's really what you're giving up. And so for me personally, you know, I left after I left like, you know, 11 months and 29 days in, but they didn't hold that against me. So, they were very nice. When I leave, after the 1 year, it's still scary because I'm going to go do something new and I'm giving up this. Well, one, you know, in hindsight, anyone that follows the Twitter stock, it's it would have been good just to leave and sell high. But because now the Twitter stock is lower than we got in at. We got in at $19.60, which when Twitter peaked over 40 a share, that was a really good spot to be in. Now I think Twitter's like I think it's just below 20. Oh yeah, 1629 as of right now. So far below what even we got in back in 2012. So I mean, it's still worth something. It's just not as grandiose as it could have been. But back then, you know, I'm walking away from this hot tech company that's going to IPO and it did well. I think, you know, as bad as it's doing now in the first, I'd say 6 to 9 months, it did really well. And then, but I'm also walking away from the salary. I'm walking away from health benefits. I'm walking away from, you know, vesting even more stock. And so it's a terrifying thing to like think about and go through and just wonder like, should I play it safe? Should I put it all on the line again? But I think, you know me enough that, you know, playing it safe is it's too boring. I got to always put it on the line. I got to go for like what we believe in. And just when we see something that's interesting or exciting, like, and no one else is bringing it to life. Cause a lot of our big ideas, they usually sit, we let them marinate for a couple years. And we usually will ideate, prototype something like almost instantaneously. But we never really take that leap to turn it into like a business or a product. And we just kind of assume somebody else will, you know, somebody will come along and they'll do it. And then when there's a good one, and nobody has, and it's been a couple of years, it's like, holy shit, like it's still good and no one's still done it. Like, and we have a prototype sitting on a shelf, like let's go. And I think we still kind of live in that. I mean, we love it here at Eventbrite, but it is hard to get away from that like feeling. The nice thing is they put us in a position where a lot of those ideas, they let us bring them to life internally, which is really nice.
So what was it at Twitter in that 11th month that made you feel like I've got to go?
Yeah. So now, you know, then it was a really hard to explain. If you had asked me that then, I don't think I could articulate it to you because I don't think that you or, you know, anybody else would have really understood because again, in 2013, when I leave, Twitter's still hot. They're going to IPO in about 60 days. And they're going to do well when it first IPOs. And, most people were like, why would you leave? And now, if anyone that truly follows Twitter, a lot of people have left. There's been a lot of turnover. I'd say the design team that I worked with, I believe 92% of them have turned over. So hardly anyone's there. None of the original Include team are there anymore. A lot of leadership has turned over. So it wasn't a really healthy place. And I feel more comfortable. I didn't want it to sound like I was, you know, talking shit about Twitter because I still love the product. I use it I tweet, you know, frantically every day, all the time, and I'm a constant consumer of it.
I remember some AIGA events you tweeted they were quite famous.
That's right. That was a good one. So big fan. But now I think it's easier for me to be a little bit more honest because I think the world has seen that there's a little bit of turmoil. It's not the healthiest place to work. I mean, there's certainly more unhealthy places that are truly unhealthy, like an Uber. But Twitter, it's like it was just unhealthy and like it wasn't fun. And there was just too much chaos, and there was still too much in their infancy to try to figure out who they are, like how they're going to grow, how they're going to make money. And there wasn't a lot of opportunity for the thing that they wanted us to do, which was kind of, you know, think bigger and innovate. They had to more, I think once they got ready for the IPO, like, you know, kind of grow up and get their shit together. Like we need to think about monthly active users and we need to think about revenue. It's like, oh shit, like got to think about revenue. Who knew? And I wish they had figured that out, like, you know, 2 years earlier, and I could just focus on the thing that I like to focus on.
So you leave Twitter, and I don't know the order that this happens, but you start Canvas, the co-working space, right? That becomes successful. I remember you got written up as a top five co-working space, I want to say in the nation, but I'm not sure if I'm right there. And then also you go into Obama's White House to start what later becomes Digital Services, right?
That's right. So when we left DC to go to Twitter, we had a beautiful office space, 6,000 square feet right in downtown DC, about, I'd say, 8 blocks from the White House in DuPont Circle. So pretty prime real estate. And we had put our heart and soul into designing this space. And again, this is another one where time dates us, because we built this space out in 2011. In 2011, it was different, man. Like there weren't like open space that was felt lofty with exposed brick and like, you know, your Crate and Barrel West Elm-esque furniture. Now when I'm saying that, everyone's just rolling their eyes, and that's like every coffee shop you walk into. But in 2011, that wasn't the case. Like Starbucks still looked like shit. But now like what I just described looks like the inside of a Taco Bell at some places, right? Like everyone gets it now. There is this, I don't know if you know, I don't know if you have it in Jacksonville, but there's a Taco Bell Cantina, which is like their upscale. And so they got a few here in San Francisco. And like, it's like you're walking into this, like, you know, old, like majestic thing, but it's still a Taco Bell. But back then, like that was super cool and trendy. And there was no, WeWork only had one space in New York City. So this is also pre WeWork. No one who's listening right now that didn't live in New York knew what a WeWork was. So co-working isn't a big thing. There's only like a handful of them in the country that even exist. And when we knew we were leaving, we didn't want to abandon this space. We didn't want to necessarily sublet it out, and we didn't want to give it over to somebody else. We wanted to keep it going because it was just, we put our heart and soul to it, and we wanted to try this co-working thing. And the Twitter deal gave us enough like sort of capital that like it didn't have to be super profitable at first, but we just figured we'd create a place in DC that could be co-working. And so it was DC's first co-working space. And it took off right away. We filled it up, and we got a bunch of, it was mostly designers, developers in there working in technology, and it just became a really cool creative spot. And then serendipitously, somebody came along and, you know, offered to buy the business from us and take over that space. And it was good timing, because now, I mean, I fully admit that like we can't compete with a WeWork. They come in like locusts and they take over. Now in DC, when we started Canvas, there were zero WeWorks, and now I believe, you know, within a 5-mile radius, there are 12 WeWorks, you know, all with over 20,000 square feet, and we had 6,000. So in the time, you know, we had the monopoly, and by the end of it, it's like, no, I don't want to deal with this shit. And like, yeah. And then like in the beginning, I used to shit on WeWork. You know, they're like the Walmarts of co-working, but like they figured out the culture thing. The spaces are pretty cool. I got a lot of friends that have offices there. Like I like working in them. So like they figured out the scale game, and like, I hope they're super successful with it, but they certainly raise enough money to kill it. And then, yeah, the Obama thing. So we start the co-working right as we leave for California. So we're doing that remote. We had an awesome person named Callie Seneff who ran that space for us.
I met her when I was there.
So she was awesome. So she just kind of like was jack of all trades. She's basically like remote CEO. She had a company of one. So she had to do everything from, play janitor to play business development and partnerships and sales. So she was amazing, and couldn't have done it without her, but she helped us keep that going remotely. And then, yeah, when I was looking to leave Twitter, you know, I was just seeing what else was out there, kind of wondering if I was going to take a day job, start something new. And just serendipitously, there was this opportunity at the White House. And I like how you were specific about the Obama White House, because now sometimes I wear some of my White House.
The White House got sold as well, only you didn't profit from that one. So
That's right. But I'll have like, you know, a White House baseball cap and I'll forget. Because it's comfortable, and I'll go out in San Francisco, and like I think people look at me like I'm racist now, and like I hate humans and immigrants and all things equality, and so it's like, oh shit, yeah, it's like I need to like preface Obama White House, but yeah, so there was an opportunity to work there, and it was really cool because it was a term position and it was only 6 months, so I thought, oh, this is perfect for someone like me, because there's no way that I can really, I don't usually survive in corporate culture, but there's no way I can survive in government culture, but 6 months I can do, and I can do some good. I can help contribute to making government a little bit better. I can do what they call like your civic duty. And then it gives me 6 months to kind of figure out what else I want to do. And it brought me back to DC, which was at that time, you know, really, really home base. And I got to like, you know, work back at Canvas and sort of focus on that business and get it to a point where it's sold.
So when you're in the White House, when you're working on the digital services for the government, like, did that impact the next move at all, or what you did next, or was that just an experience that you had and you learned from it?
So, I mean, it impacts my life. I always refer to it as the most fascinating and frustrating experience of my life. Fascinating, just the work that we're doing, the people I'm working with, but frustrating because, you know, it's government. It moves a little slow, and so that's hard for somebody that, you know, is been trained their whole life to, you know, move fast and break things. They don't break anything and take your time, right? So it's like, okay, that's tough. And it's hard because they want you to make an impact, but they'll freak out over every little dent. And that's hard to be in a place where all they talk about is impact, but all they see are dents. And it's like, I don't think they realize that like one is just a bigger version of the other. But they'll say things like, hey, you know, let's be innovative. But they'll also say, well, don't do anything new that's never been tested. I was like, well, you just contradicted yourself. But I get the spirit of what you want. So I loved it. And it's changed me a lot. I think it's helped make me become more patient. I don't think I was as patient when I was there. I tried to change them, and like that's not super healthy. But I think ultimately they changed me, so I slowed down a little bit. I think I figured out how to become a little bit more political, a little bit more. I mean, obviously, but you know, play the game, understand like, you know, behavioral economics, incentives, like how people work, how to get things done, and how to move fast, but like without freaking everybody out. And then from my side, I'd already known that I knew it was a 6 month term. So I already knew what I was going to do. And I knew what it was next. We knew we were going to build Invite. And I say we, because I basically kind of brought back the old team. I had Alex, who was still working at Twitter, but I told him what we're going to do. He's like, hey, I'm going to stick it out here for a bit. But I got the rest of the gang and said, put them on slowly. First one was a guy named Michael Dick, who was actually our very first intern at Include when he was only 19. But, you know, now he's a grown adult. And I said, hey, you know, I got this crazy idea. You know, here's how much money I'll put into it. So I'll pay you, you know, a modest salary. And why don't you come down to DC? And I got this big house. Why don't you live there for a year for free? And like, that'll be part of your salary. And like, we'll call it an extended vacation. And we're just going to build this thing. And he brings with him a guy that we had worked with as a contractor at Include named Evan. And then another guy that we'd worked with at Include, Brandon Vaughn. And then we just get started going to work. And I told them basically, I had done initial designs, wireframes, and I had the basic, you know, business model laid out. And I basically told them, hey, make me a productized MVP. Something that people are going to drop over. You got 6 months to do it. And in those 6 months, when I'm done with the White House, because the White House was like a 100-hour a week job. You know, they only pay you for 40, but like everyone there just puts their heart and soul into it. So I can't juggle two things, which is another reason why we kind of wanted to sell the co-working space. It's like there's just too much on the plate. So 6 months goes by. We got this awesome prototype. People are jaw dropping, and then we go out and we raise some money. We get $1 million, and then we start building it as like a real thing, and we got like a real company all of a sudden, and we're back and risking it all over again.
That sounded like the Steve Martin book, How to Be a Millionaire. First, get $1 million. So we went out, we got $1 million. So, but was that based on connections you made at Silicon Valley beforehand, or was that? Like, how did you go out? How did you learn that game? Because you hadn't done that before.
Yeah, never had to do that before. So we never had investors on anything we'd ever done. We'd always just self-funded because the original thing was just the agency. So all you really needed then was you know, two people with a pulse, and you could, you needed to afford the cheapest laptop that had internet connection, right? That's it. So really easy to get into the agency game. As I mean, talent's the most valuable thing there. So you got to kind of bring that with you. And then, yeah, Canvas, we just, that was built on the back of the agency. So all those, money, we put it into Canvas. And then, with this, you know, I used some of my Twitter money to kick it off, but, what was the question again?
How did you approach
getting... how did I raise the money? Yeah. So, never done it before. Didn't have experience there. Just talked to a handful of people that were, really good about giving us advice. And, to be perfectly candid, like, we had a lot of unique things going for us. One, being that we raised all the money in Washington, D.C., which is a rare thing for a small consumer-based startup to raise. I mean, and again, 2013, $1 million was a much, and it's going to sound, some people are going to roll their eyes when I say $1 million is not a lot of money.
I'm already rolling my eyes.
In 2013, raising $1 million was like, that's a big freaking deal. Now, like, I feel like it kind of feels like people are raising $1 million for, you know, for
now it's a letdown, right? They got a million. I don't know.
Yeah. It almost seems like you didn't do very well in your race to only raise a million. But in DC, to raise $1 million from someone who's never raised before for a consumer-based like startup in the event space, which is like super crowded. There's a million of them, and they've been going on since 1999, like the Evites and Eventbrites of the world. It's pretty good, but it was luck. And one is that like I got a cool story that I was able to just kind of tell, right? So a lot of it, they're investing in the person, but you got a big fish, small pond scenario where there isn't a lot of Silicon Valley people in DC. I just came back from there at Twitter, which at that time is super hot. And I had just sold my last business to Twitter, which again kind of adds to a story. So there's this, you know, okay, maybe this guy has something, right? And I both know I got nothing, but they didn't know that. and so that helps. But a lot of it was connections that I'd built over the years. Like there's this guy, Paul Singh, and I had known him from DC days, long time ago. And he went on to help start 500 startups. And he leaves 500. And he's thinking about his next thing. And I was in Silicon Valley at the time. And he knew we had sold to Twitter. So he hit me up and he asked me for money for his startup. And I was like, huh. I'll do some investing. So I gave him 25K. And I was like, okay, I'm going to invest in this thing. I think you're super smart. I don't really understand what you're doing, but I'm curious to see where this goes. And it was kind of one of my, probably my third startup investment. So I was kind of like excited to see where that road goes. And I'm down with like losing a little bit of money to learn something here. And again, I know that's $25,000 is not a little bit of money, but it was a big deal for me at the time. Still is a big deal. But long story short, he ends up coming to DC himself and starting a $10 million venture fund to back DC-based startups. And so I go to him and kind of say, hey, man,
I remember when you asked me.
Any chance you want to invest in me? And he says, yeah, come down to my office. I come. We go get cheeseburgers. And he's like, I love it. I love everything you're doing. I'm in. He's like, my only question is, I don't know if I should give you $100,000 or $250,000. And I was just like, Paul, I think you should give me $250,000. So it's not his money, right? Like he has this fund. And so he gives us $250,000. And that's a game changer. Like when you're raising money, the hardest thing to do is get your lead investor. And once we had a lead investor and we had, you know, 1/4 of the funds set up, like that really made it easy. And we actually had our first investor was a guy named Steve Gans, who's early at LinkedIn, actually is based in DC now. And he's a fucking awesome guy, but he's the first one that gives us money, and that kicks it all off. And then it just kind of trickles in after that. And then after that, we go to this group that I'm actually a venture partner at now called NextGen. And there's this guy there that runs it, Dan Mindus. And he was fantastic because he handheld us through the whole thing. He's like, he's basically like, here's what you say, here's what you don't say. I mean, in a very positive way, talked to us like we were 4 years old and really like said, hey, you know, here's how you'll fuck this up and here's how you won't. So here's what I suggest. And like, I'm so appreciative of him because, you know, the ability to treat us like children and help us through that path.
Well, and the time that we've spent together, whenever I asked you a question that I felt like you were going to do something that felt off or whatever, you always had this, it wasn't condescending, it wasn't cocky, it was this level of confidence where you would just kind of look at me and go, hey, you know, it's what I'm going to do. And it's one of those things that I can imagine you in some of those meetings, not when you're being talked to like a 4-year-old by somebody who's super experienced and is educating you, but in some of those other fundraising meetings where you've got the other investors coming in, where you're just like, hey, if you don't want to be a part of it, that's totally cool. Right. And it's not, not dismissive. It's just like, hey, it's up to you. I'm not here to sell you. I'm just telling you what's happening.
Yeah. I think it also helped. I mean, I got to cheat a lot because we'd done the Twitter thing, which gives me a little bit of money in the bank. So a lot of them knew that, like, I can do it. Yeah. Without them. I'd rather have them to help and push us forward. I like having the accountability of having an investor. I like knowing, and again, I'm thinking down the road. Yeah. Could I have, funded some of this on my own? Certainly. But like, eventually this thing's going to grow and I'm going to need a Series A. My understanding was the order of operations, raise a seed round first, show that you can do something with that investment, and then raise a Series A. So I threw the Series A anyway. I might as well just follow the normal order of operations and do the seed round. I have a good friend. Oh, you know her, Jenna Marino, or Jenna Haney.
Oh, yeah.
Now.
Absolutely.
Her and I were, drunk ranting, as we always do, one day in DC about a decade ago. And we were just, it was probably like the second time we'd ever met each other. But so it was, friendship, love at first sight. And we're talking about design and, what it takes to be a good designer. And we came to the drunken conclusion that design is 50% selling. And I think when we say that, what we're really talking about is confidence, being able to articulate your work and explain why you made the decisions you did. And that always stuck with me as a designer. And so I just pull that into everything. So you're totally right that it's the confidence, right? Just, I strongly believe in why this will work and why we made the decisions that we did, why we're doing what we're doing. And I had an answer for everything. Like when I show a design and someone asks me, why is it purple? Like not just why is it purple? Why is it that hue of purple? Why not a little lighter, a little darker? Like I can articulate that, and I can defend it and I can bring it back to like a business objective or something that's more than, just like a subjective aesthetic decision. And so I do the same thing with the business. I'll say like, this is why we're going down this path, why this market. And I'm not steadfast in any of that. I just say, here's why I'm confident on it. And if you can disagree with why we make the decision that we did, then like, let's change the decision. But if you understand the logic that we did, then let's go forward. And I think that the investors appreciate that. Whereas I'm not as stubborn as I am confident. I'm confident in that we put a lot of time and effort and we thought into this decision. But if you can refute it, yeah. I mean, that's actually what I would prefer you to do. I hate when people ask for advice because what they're really asking for is validation. They just want me to agree with them. It's like, you're just wasting my time. Like the best thing I can do is have put a lot of time and thought into something, feel really strongly about it with strong conviction that this is the right path. And for you to undo all of that, because if I can't take that, all I'm going to do is figure out what you already know, and I'm going to spend a lot of money and time doing it. I'd rather you just tell me that I'm wrong right now.
Yeah. Okay. So with Twitter came to you, Apple and Twitter came to you, but with Invite, you're going to go on the road and try to sell it. Is that right?
Ish, I guess. We didn't really say like go on the road and like try to sell it. So I'll kind of tell it in two ways. I'll tell one part of it and then I'll go back in time. So when we know we're going to raise this. So you raise the seed round, and the idea is that you spend that money, right? You raise $1 million, and the investors. I think a lot of people like that haven't been through it. You kind of think, hey, you put that in the bank and you save it for a rainy day if you need it, and you be very responsible with how you spend it. That is not what they'd like you to do. They want you to spend that $1 million, and they want you to do it quickly in like 18 to 24 months because they want you to spend it building the business so that the business becomes more valuable, so that you can raise more money, so you can do it all over again. And I know for a lot of people, like, doesn't make a lot of sense. Like, you're just constantly in the business of raising money, but they want you to get to $100 million business, and that you gotta build a quick sales team, and you gotta have a really strong product to sell. So you got to put money behind that. So that's what they want the investment to go to. So we're on this path. We spend our $1 million, and as we get towards the end of running out of it, the order of operations, we got to raise more money. So in the Series A, you can do one of two things. You can raise more money, or it's also, you have an interesting thing at this point. You have a business that is making money, that has a product that is unique in this space. So it's also an interesting time for have conversation, acquisition conversations. So just to do our fair due diligence, we start having those conversations. I reach out to a few people that I know in the events industry and say, hey, you know, we're raising the Series A, but I think it's a good time just to at least have the conversation. And we have a conversations with a lot of different groups in the ticketing space, outside of the ticketing space, some in the music space, just people that are thinking about the kind of problems that we've solved. And we start having these conversations, and you know, the one that ends up coming to fruition is the Eventbrite one, and it ultimately makes more sense for us to sell the business to Eventbrite and partner with them than it does to go out and try to raise that Series A, even if we could be successful with it and take the business to the next level. So we make that decision as a team. But the Eventbrite conversation specifically, we actually started our conversation with them like 3 months in to an Invite. Like we didn't even really have a product yet. And so I had our second intern at Include, the agency. Again, it always comes back to Include. It always comes back to team. It always comes back to relationships. I'm big on like, I piss a lot of people off, but I really try not to because they come back and save my life many times over. But this intern, Lauren Moon, my favorite intern, but definitely one of our most talented, just because she's fun and she's crazy, but she's a very talented designer. She worked at Eventbrite. After she interned with us, she went back to California and she got a job at Eventbrite. And we were getting into the event space. So I just told her, I was like, hey, I'm starting this thing. You know, I'd love to like pick your brain about it because you work at Eventbrite, so you might have some good insights. And she tells me, she's like, oh, I think what you're doing is really interesting. I'm going to connect you with our VP of strategy. I was like, oh, well, that's cool. And he thought it was interesting enough that he said, hey, why don't I fly you and your founders out here and just to show us what you've been working on. And I'm kind of nervous because we hadn't worked on much, like this right. 3 months in. But I'm like, yeah, I like a free flight to San Francisco. You know, if anything, that's one step to taking Eventbrite down is the $200 flight. that'll hurt their bottom line. And so they fly us out here. And we demo for them. And I think they thought what we're doing is interesting. I think they probably thought it was more like cute than groundbreaking, but like they didn't dislike any of it. But we just stayed in contact. It wasn't like, hey, you know, we want to buy this thing that doesn't exist yet. It was like, okay. And they said a few things that I don't think they realized that were very important to us, where like, you know, the VP of strategy at the time, he says just by happenstance that like fraud detection is a big deal for them. And they have an entire team. I think it was like 30 people who do nothing but like look at fraud and write algorithms for fraud. And I just took note. I said, oh, didn't even consider that. Like we're getting into this transaction business and people would use that, you know, for evil.
Yeah, to scam.
It's like, okay, maybe we should think about fraud. And like it saved our ass that we were, because he had let known that like most of the small startups he sees go out of business because they can't handle fraud. And that was just top of mind for us. It's like, oh shit, I guess we're in the fraud business now. But he not said that, we totally would fall into that trap because there definitely were times where we caught it early and fast, people trying to use the system for evil. But yeah, so we'd always been in contact with them. And I'd say every 6 to 9 months, I'd sync with this particular VP of strategy and just show him what we've been working on. And the last time that him and I met in DC, when he was on the East Coast, it clicked for him, this new thing that we were working on, which is called our community platform. But he saw that we started to think about Eventbrite not as a competitor, but as something we could complement. So we, because in the beginning, all we did was want to take Eventbrite customers. And so we would just, right. You know, we'd find the ones that wanted the thing that we did better and we would take them. And to them, you know, every little customer we took wasn't a big deal to them, but to us, it was a monumental moment because it was a lot of revenue. But we started to look at the customers that we couldn't take and why we couldn't take them, but they still wanted what we offered. And we started to figure out, is there a way where we could treat Eventbrite not like a product that we compete with, but like a platform that we build on top of? And just that thinking was kind of revolutionary at the time for Eventbrite, where, hey, what if Eventbrite's not a product? What if it's a platform? And what if other people could build on it? And that's what we did. And we became partners with them. They started sending us business, which is like, whoa, this is kind of cool. now they're sending us revenue. This is awesome. These were like, for us, big deals. And then that relationship just became more clear. And that's why we were having those Series A conversations. Like we were just kind of clear with them, said, hey, just want to let you know, like we're going to go out and raise, you know, this money, but we are talking to other companies about potential acquisitions. And they said, yeah, like, you know, let's have that conversation. So it was a little of us going to them, a little of them coming to us, but yeah, we were more proactive with them.
But, and what I realize as I listen to you tell these stories is that you were always reaching out to other people. And like you said, it's about the relationships from the beginning, right? And even if you did piss people off, and I'm confident that you did,
yeah,
you're also so lovable, right? It's like, I can imagine that you were able to smooth out most of the ruffled feathers, right? But
yeah, yeah. Well, I think everyone knows. I mean, if you don't know this, you're most likely somebody I don't care that I pissed off. But I think everyone knows that at the end of it, I want to do more good than bad. So I'm only after doing what's best, I believe, for the – I'll always think about my team first, selfishly. So my team first, the product, and then in relation to the user, and then, you know, thinking about the bigger business. So I always kind of take that order of operations. I know that isn't true for everybody. A lot of people, you know, will say like, hey, you know, user first, customer first. I'm a big believer that like I will always pick the team over the user, because what's the point of servicing a user without a team to build a product, right? Like you need a really great team to build a really great product to service a really great customer. And I can only see it in that order of operations. I can't do the inverse. I can't have a really great customer, then build a really great product for them, and then have a really great team that can build that product. I need to start with the team. But they're the ones that have, you know, been like, I mean, Alex and I, like a decade and a half now. It's crazy. Like most of my adult life working with one guy on like four different ventures. And then like all the Envite team, like we've all been working together for about five years, even before Envite started. So like we know each other really well. We know how to work really well together. And I hope to continue to work with a lot of them. I hope to continue to work with people from the White House, people from Eventbrite in the future, people from Twitter. So like, yeah, those relationships are like everything to me. But I have this tattoo now. I only have two, but this one, a lot of people, they don't like it because it sounds so negative, but it says, may the bridges I burn light the way. And what I really, so a lot of people are like, oh, don't burn bridges, Marty, like shouldn't burn bridges. But my point is that I think I get frustrated with people who are so focused on not burning the bridge that they don't do the right thing. They don't do right by their team. They don't do right by their product. And they don't do right by their customer, because they're so focused on like, if I burn the relationship, you know, I won't get the promotion or I won't get the salary increase. And yeah, I'm coming from a total point of privilege now. If we just spent like an hour and, you know, 47 minutes talking about like all these successes. So like, I totally get this, but like, I want to come from a position of like, I want to be able to say like, you know, no, like I will take the position that like, I would rather get fired than do the wrong thing. And again, that sounds, because I had a little healthy Twitter fight with somebody who's like, you know, hey, that's, I understand the spirit of what you're saying, but like you're totally speaking from a point of privilege. So like not everyone can just say, hey, fuck it, I'm going to quit my job because I don't do what's right. But, you know, I'm talking about what's doing right, like something stupid, like a user interface item for like, you know, making the customer, you know, have the right experience and like just not believe in doing it. But I mean, if you look at it another way, you know, if you work in an environment where someone's being, you know, physically or emotionally abusive, or tearing down other groups within your company, I'm going to say that you shouldn't stand for that, and you know, we should do everything we can to get the abusive person out. But if you work at an environment that won't change and like and puts up with that, like, I'm a believer that I want to leave that place, right? And I've never worked at a place like that, or maybe I'm from a point of privilege where I've never had to experience it, so I haven't seen it firsthand. But I want to believe that like that's true with everything. Like if I've got to fight and I got to put my own reputation on the line to do what's right in any capacity, like that's what I want to do. And if I got to burn a bridge, like that sucks. But I found like I have the benefit of time now, that like almost two decades into working here, that anyone that's ever disliked working with me at some point in the past, now they've come around. Certainly I've gotten a little more mature and I'm a little bit easier to work with, but they've, when I've talked to them in the future, it's like, hey, you know, you were right back then. And like this was what we should have done. And it's like, it makes me feel a little better. It's also, it just adds fuel to the fire. Cause now like it encourages me to burn more bridges, but I just don't want people to be scared to burn them. Like, don't have confidence to like do what's right and push forward, especially if it's for your team, your product, and your customer.
Well, and so you said it, you're 20 years in, I'm 30 years in. It's like, you don't get that time back. And if you spent that time staring at something instead of doing something, you're going to lose, you know? depending on your definition of winning. But to me, it's like, if you're not moving forward in a direction that makes you feel like you are growing as a person, not necessarily financially or whatever else, those things are nice, but then you're just stagnant and I couldn't handle it. You know what I realized when I was talking about smoothing ruffled feathers, we didn't even talk about macaw.
Oh yeah.
So what was Macaw? I remember I saw you at South by Southwest. I wore a t-shirt and I acted like I knew what it was. But it was a CMS, right?
So it was a design tool. And again, this is going to be one of those things where we have to like remember the context of time, because now I talk about like a web-based design tool that like outputs really good code and everyone rolls their eyes and is like, there's a million of those. But like when Macaw first dropped, like this was an inconceivable notion that like you could have, you know, something like a photo. And this is even before like Sketch is like a prominent thing. Like now it's like, what the, like people are like rolling their eyes like, what's Photoshop? Like you use Photoshop for like website design, but you would use Photoshop. Like, but if you could have something like a Photoshop that could but output instead of a PSD HTML CSS, but like that was actually good HTML CSS, like that would be groundbreaking. And like just to have it be smart to know that if in your design file that you started using Helvetica more than Trebuchet, that the CSS that writes out should, you know, treat that font as the dominant font, you know, like add it to the body instead of like a very specific thing. Like that'd be really intelligent if a code sort of editor could understand your intentions and design. And that's what they built, and that was super awesome. But yeah, Tom, who starts the company, he worked with us at Include. Again, it all comes back to Include. It was amazing 12 human beings, probably the most amazing 12 human beings on the planet that I've ever worked with. But he goes to Twitter with us. He's the first to leave. He goes to MIT, works there, and then he's always had this idea for Macaw. He tells Alex and I about it, and he's like 5 minutes into describing it. We're like, stop. Your level of passion for whatever the hell you're about to describe is like off the charts. We're in whatever capacity we can be in, we're in. Like you let us know right now, like if it's writing a check, if it's like being on a board, if it's like doing sales, if it's making phone calls, you tell us, you put us to work. We are in on this thing. Don't even finish describing it. But he ends up telling us what it is. And we're like, yeah, this is super cool. It sounds like an impossible task. I can't imagine that. Like he had a guy that he'd worked with in the past he's going to bring on, and they were going to start it together. And we're like, it doesn't sound like what I just described, that two human beings could make it. They end up having a team of four, and they build it. And it's awesome. And it ends up getting acquired by Envision. And that whole team's there now. I can't say too much about what Envision's working on, but from what I understand, I can only imagine big, enormous things are coming out of that team that are going to leave us all pretty jaw-dropped.
Before Adobe swipes them up.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. Like, there's just so many of these cool design tools out there, which is awesome time to be a designer on the web.
I know. Where were they in 2003, man?
I know, right?
So Macaw was kind of a little bit of a side swipe for you then. It wasn't necessarily one of the – I mean, it wasn't invite. It didn't like – it wasn't your passion. It was you saw the passion of someone else and that you knew well and jumped in.
Yeah, so we didn't – yeah, we were never like W-2 employees, Alex and I. We were first – I think only investor. I don't know if anyone else, because he took like a little friends and family. I think it's just Alex and I. And then they got acquired like right before they did a Kickstarter. That's right. And they raised $350,000.
So $350,000
plus our initial investment. That was enough to build the first version of Macaw. And then I think they were going to do the jump right to A. They weren't going to, because they didn't really need the C round, because they'd had the Kickstarter. And that's kind of went down the same path as us. Like when you have that A, Series A conversation, start talking to people who are interested in acquiring you. And Envision was like, him, he had a relationship. Tom's very same way. He had a lot of long-term relationships. He knew Clark from Envision for a long time. And he'd always kept Clark in the loop. And Clark was like, no, with what you guys have built and the aspirations of where Envision's going, like this is a match made in heaven. And so Alex and I, we kind of helped Alex more on the design development side wherever he could, and me on the sales, business development, kind of just thinking through problems, getting on calls if I could, any relationships I had with like educational institutions to see if they could buy licenses of Macaw in the beginning. Kind of like sitting on their board and just being an investor. But that one was cool because it was a time where like something was awesome and big and had a good story, but like we didn't start it. Somebody else did. We could just be a part of their ride.
So now your day to day is at Eventbrite?
Yep. Every day, 9 to 5 here right now in one of their office rooms. And they're pretty cool. Invite still runs pretty autonomously. Invite, the product is still out there. We're building a version of it that's going to launch pretty soon here that will be more integrated with the Eventbrite product line, but it basically gives big brands more control over their their brand on the Eventbrite product. So Spotify is a really good example. A lot of Spotify events are on Eventbrite, but they don't have to look like your typical Eventbrite event. They can look more like a Spotify event. We can, you know, we can put a custom TLD there. So you can really start to remove Eventbrite, the brand, from the experience, which is a point of contention here sometimes. You know, is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? If you just talk about like branding in general, you know, should there be a level of consistency? If people know how to use Eventbrite, how to check out with Eventbrite, should we ever get in the way of that? You know, is the Spotify brand the parent brand, or is the Eventbrite brand the parent brand, right? Should we make the experience more like what you're used to in Spotify, or should we make it more like what you're used to in Eventbrite? And so it's something that we talk about a lot. We brainstorm a lot, but that's pretty fun and exciting. Eventbrite's constantly growing. So they just acquired Ticketfly, which is pretty exciting because now on the Eventbrite side, we're doing a lot of thinking around, you know, what can we do with what we build for the music industry, for festivals. And that's always exciting stuff for us. So hopefully, you know, we got some big, exciting events down at more of them at South by Southwest again.
Well, Marty, it was great catching up.
Yeah, man. I love it.
I have to tell you.
When am I going to see you next?
I'm exhausted just hearing about everything that you've done.
So, sorry, I could talk to
you. You know what? I think you might see me next February at Owner Summit because I got to find a way to get you there. It was so good catching up with you, and everybody listening, thank you. And we'll be back soon. I'll talk to you later.
All right, man. Thank you. Bye.